We're back. Hour three at the races. Graham Motion just with us. And got to mention, too, that I know that, Rick Hammerly on his way with Gina to off to Oaklawn. And they're driving right now, might be listening. And it's their wedding anniversary. So happy anniversary to the Hammerlys. And I hear Andy Serling in the background. Andy, happy new year.
Did you withhold the exciting anniversary news for the Hammerlys for my appearance because you know how much I love those idiotic things when you do them on your show?
Well, I thought that you wouldn't mind.
I did save it. Very touching that you wished a happy anniversary to the Hammerlys, and I really hope they're listening. But I actually hope that he's listening to the Dead and not your show.
He might be listening to the Dead channel.
For music. By the way, there's hammering going on in the apartment below me. I can't do anything about it. So it might be a little noisy.
Is it you that somebody told me? Who was it that? Oh, it was John Parada, actually. John, they're working on his building, and he says he can't work at all. He can't do any writing.
Does he have any birthdays or anniversaries coming up we should touch on?
He got married. He got married last week. Congratulations to John and to Maggie on their wedding.
There you go. Good. And we'll know that in a week. I mean, what do you do next year when you're on vacation during his anniversary? How do you deal with the this? You get like a special show?
You know what I'll do? I will tape. That's a tremendous idea. I can tape.
Where's the picture of Graham Motion, by the way?
That
12 in that one?
That's when he was working in Maryland and, back when he was working for Jonathan Shepherd.
But he's not working in Maryland?
I guess he is still working in Maryland. That's great. Good point. You make a great point.
That's a better point.
It's the first great
it's
point
better
of
be
the
good.
Year.
You're interrupting Magnolia.
Ooh, nice. Well, you can share your thoughts on the holiday fortnight. We're back racing and the action at Aqueduct off to a good end of the year, beginning of the year.
Okay, yeah, no, the race has been good. The field size has been good. Unfortunately, it was wet tracks every day last weekend.
Yeah,
so it'd be nice to get some dry tracks because there's no weather. But the racing's been good and competitive. I mean, I don't think there are any particularly scintillating performances over the weekend, but the racing's been good. Been good size, field size, and panel numbers have been good. I guess the bigger news is that we altered the pick six, and we're offering the pick six with no carryover at all, paying the pool every day. I have mixed feelings about that, but I'm really thrilled that they are trying something and getting away from the jackpot. I mean, we're not confirming we're going to do this past January. They're looking at the numbers, but I'm glad that we're investigating other options. So we'll see how that works out. But that's at least through January. I have no idea whether they're planning on staying that or not. I don't know if they know.
Well, you do get the sense that there's some serious reevaluation going on. In fact, I'm going to talk to Frank Hopp from Sam Houston next. They're forcing out that leftover pot from last year when they had to abandon the season, and it looks like they're reconsidering moving away as well from a jackpot style.
Yeah, jackpots are an unfortunate thing. I've never hidden the fact that I rue the day they began, and I think they're terrible for racing in a lot of ways. They give credence and fairly so give credence to the argument that people aren't particularly price sensitive. The takeout discussion is a very big discussion, and the idea that some people discuss it as though it's the same as it was in 1990 is not, because we're in a sort of global, or at least as far as, global, but pretty much, the ecosystem is all racetracks, whereas, if you before simulcasting, if you lowered your takeout, the money stayed in your own individual ecosystem, and it just doesn't work that way. So unless there's a coordinated effort, and I'm not, and there's a lot of reasons why that's not going to happen, or it's harder to happen, but certainly jackpot bets gave a better argument for people that wanted that kept takeouts high. So, but also the distribution of the money from the regular player to the CAW players is exorbitant in these types of bets. And, you know, it's one thing to have CAW players in the pools at different levels, some tracks much higher than others, us and Naira on the lower end of that scale. But that's one thing. You know, there's nothing that says the parimutuel pools, you know, exclude people. But it's one of the differences between ourselves and something that's coming up more and more now is sports wagering. You know, people are starting to see how much these companies will try to limit the wagering of people who are successful players. That doesn't happen in racing, but in the jackpots, they've just, you know, they're just designed in a way for them to really scoop up the money. And these jackpots, these carryovers are built in the backs of small players, and it's distributed to the huge players. And it just takes money out of circulation for periods of time. It takes money out of circulation, period. And, you know, I understand it's a tricky argument, but the reality is that the people who are playing them up to the mandatory payouts often end up are the ones who really get burned the most. And it just seems like an unfair bet. We've got so many good multi-race bets without these jackpots. I know where they started at Gulfstream, and listen, people have responded betting. It's hard because if you're a racetrack executive and people are saying to you, why aren't you putting in a jackpot bet? What are you supposed to do? Say, I'm protecting you from yourself? I don't know. It's a hard argument, but I think that the industry and the game would be better off if they were eliminated. That's just what I think.
You and I have discussed this, repeatedly. We've had input from virtually, you know, every thoughtful mind around the game when they were proliferating and when, you know, there was the hubbub being created by, you know, the biggest force out days. Maury Wolf weighed in. I had Paul Matisse talk about this. Steve and Andy, both Chris and Beyer weigh in. And it's one of these odd things that, seems to have one set of realities that might not, you know, the evidence might not be as conclusive as people think. It's pretty insidious. I mean, it's simply
insidious. I agree. And, you know, I appreciate the fact that people I work for at the track, whether it's Tony Alvato or Dave O'Rourke, you know, when we put that bet in, and, you know, it's not as though there weren't a lot of, reservations, but, you know, I said to Tony, I'm not promoting this bet. Tony said, I get it, you know. I know, you know, you're on record. You don't like them. And no, there was never a, you work for Naira, you have to love everything we do. And I do love a lot that we do at Naira. And I don't mind being a shill for Naira. I don't. I love Naira. I grew up loving Naira. Doesn't mean I don't think we make mistakes. And I'm happy to talk about things. But I'm very pro-Naira. And I think what's good for Naira is good for the industry. It's good for the entire industry and racing all over the world. And I felt this long before I worked there, that there are a lot of participants in the industry that don't appreciate what we do for racing. That doesn't mean, no, I agree with everything we do, and there was never any pressure on me to say, oh, now I love jackpot bets. You know, I don't. And listen, I think the fact that, you know, just over a little over a year after we started this, the fact that we're able as an organization take a step back and say, let's reevaluate this and see if we should do something else, I think that's a real credit to Naira that we did that, you know, and I hope that other tracks take our lead on that. And it's, and I'm not telling people what to do. I do believe that if I could convince people not to play jackpot wagers, I think I'd be helping them. I know I wouldn't be hurting them.
Well,
and there are a lot of things in the world that are illegal that really fun if you do them one day. there may be reasons that doing it every day would not be so fun. You know, it's hard. You know, you live in a world where, you know, it's a large discussion, but we have the right to offer what, you know, what we make for our racing, what we choose to offer or not offer. There is a line because you want to give people what they want.
What they think they want, and think, you know, things come in and out of fashion as well. It's kind of interesting that, you know, we had the multi-race wager scenario where, for whatever reason, you know, the pick six was, you know, had become an institution and had become the big pot bet, and, you know, for real serious players with the $2 increment, and we had, you know, the pick three, pick four, and for whatever reason, the pick five concept was sort of laying there without, you know, without purchase, and then suddenly it's become a value play because people have, the tracks understood that this was an opportunity for a, you know, well-priced, you know, large multi-race, and, you know, you see the handle numbers. I mean, the pick five has become, you know, the prime attractive wager industry-wide.
Well, it's particularly good at NYRA because of the lack of CAW participation. There isn't
yes.
any. So it makes it even better for players. But, no, I agree, and I think it gives people a chance. Listen, it's in the same way that pick sixes were appealing in the beginning with carryovers and such, but this is to a lesser extent. But I agree, it's worked very well. People like it, and, you know, and obviously the appeal to racetracks of popular multi-race wagers is they'll get people look at the entire sequence and they play the pick five, but that doesn't preclude them from getting involved in the other races as well. And just as you know that when, you know, you had regular pick six carryovers, it would increase the handle in the other races as well, as people would get involved in races they might not normally have looked at, but they looked because of the carryovers. So it's all positive. And I think it's healthy to increasing interest in the game is what we're trying to do. You know, I think that one of the things, you know, there aren't enough executives in this game that are betters. And I think that's a positive that Tony Alvarado has brought, is that Tony's, you know, done some wagering in his life, you know. So he understands betting in a way that a lot of executives don't. So, and not to say that Tony and I always agree on everything, because he and I argue as much as anybody, but I think from a point of respect, and that I think that's the real positive that Tony has brought to us. And somebody, and you know, Dave Roark was never really a better, though. He talks to me and he talks to other betters, and he wants to, you know, he understands the better sensibilities. But there's a difference between that and actually having been somebody who's bet a lot during your life. And there's no substitute for being involved in gambling. You know, that's why it frustrates me. I mean, I think one of the most unfortunate aspects of people in my job is if they're not betting on a regular basis. And I'm not suggesting that just because somebody has my job, they should be betting $100 in every horse they like. But there should be some number that's a slightly higher than they're totally comfortable with. And maybe that's $10 a race. I'm not suggesting it has to be some big amount. But I do think that if people are going on the air and giving out opinions, they should be willing to put their money behind it. Now, I don't think they have to put money on 4 to 5 shots they pick, but I think if you're going on the air and saying, I like this 10-to-1 shot, you should be willing to bet your own money on it. Because if you're telling other people you could recommend they bet on it, you should be willing to put your own money on it. And I think because it's not some sort of punishment or penalty. In fact, if your opinion's good, it's not a punishment at all. It's a benefit. But I think it would discourage people from just taking stabs and throwing out long shots to try to look smart. That's something that I think is an unfortunate aspect that some people do. You know, have reasons to back it up, but back it up with your own money. And don't just throw out long shots and try to, you know, occasionally once every year hit a big price and pretend that means that you are smart.
Well, on this topic, actually, Andy, I think it'd be useful to go back to Friday or Thursday to New Year's Eve and that force out, because there were two favorites, a third choice, a fifth choice, an eighth choice, and a fourth choice, and it ended up paying $106,675, the force out, and it drew.
Well, it's unfortunate. it was a good and fortunate sequence that showed why those bets are bad for the regular player. There was nobody that plays at any kind of level under $200 that had a real chance to hit that thing. And that's the problem that used to happen frequently at Gulfstream, and I single them out not to pick on them, but to say because they're the first ones that brought it in. And listen, PJ was the race editor, and I mean, PJ and I are good friends, but I disagreed with PJ. You know, they would have like six impossible races in the sequence, and I understand why they did it because they're trying to increase handle all their races and everything, and I get it. But man, it just seemed like, can't you have a couple of smaller fields, a couple of mid-sized fields, and a couple of big fields so at least the little guy has a chance? And invariably, they had no chance, and they should have not played, period, you know, but they did. And I understand why people wanted to get involved, but, you know, nobody really had much chance, and invariably there would be two difficult horses in the sequence. Then getting them both on your ticket for a relatively modest amount of money was impossible. And all of these things are problems with the bet. I mean, those are auxiliary problems, but, you know, you want to make it, you'd like to, you know, it's like this argument that we're going to have a 4-horse stake or a 5-horse stake and there's a 2-to-5 shot. So we're going to take that race and keep it out of the pick six. No, put it in the pick six. It'll increase your handle. Because the average person will say, hey, I have a free square in here. You know, it's become a pick five. It's going to help your handle. It doesn't hurt your handle. You know, one thing, and you know, that I remember many years ago, the doc saying this to me, and you know, there's no smarter person about betting and, you know, pick six, struggling these things. And he said, and it may seem simple, but it's not. It's one of these, it's one of these very intelligent, very helpful concepts of that, pick sixes don't depend on one or two horses. He said, you know, you get a pick six with 2, 3 to 5 shots, and it can still pay a lot of money. It's not dependent on short price. It depends on what happens in the other legs. And I know that's sort of obvious when you think about it, but a lot of people don't realize that. They go, oh, I'm not going to play this. It's chalky because there's a couple of big favorites. I mean, I had a pick six for 156,000 or something like that, 13 years ago, almost 14 years ago, in fact. And there was a 3-to-5 shot in the sequence. Hmm. So it's not like, you know, it just doesn't, one short price, it has nothing, will not. I mean, obviously, if there are 5 short prices, it matters, but one or two don't.
Yeah,
it's also short pick fives, pick fours. I mean, you can hit pick fives especially. Hit short prices, but pick a couple of long shot at a mid-price horse home, you'll do just fine.
This was made. I don't want to say unhittable, but it was made infinitely more difficult by the second leg where that Lady by Choice with Cardenas for Lolita.
Absolutely,
Chicago.
Right. Once that horse won, I just groaned. I didn't play. I groaned and thought, great. Now, you know, whenever we have mandatory payouts, honestly, I do something I never do. I root for the favorite to win every race.
Yeah.
I'd love to see a sequence, you know, with if not the favorite, a second choice here and there. But, you know, where the little person has a chance to recoup their money. I always root for that. You know, and when a horse like that wins Lady by Choice, it's just depressing. You know? But, and I hate to be in that situation, you know? You want people to bet long shots. If they win, you get rewarded. But in that situation, it's just, I felt sort of crappy about it.
Well, and when you fold in, and not to pick on Lolita, but she was over 37 on the year, and she wins two races on the day. I didn't know what to say. I sat there, just sort of.
Well, it was a wet track. One of them was kind of logical, right?
Yes, the first one was. Yeah, the Pete Garrett.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was a wet track, and weird things happen on wet tracks. So I didn't make too much of it. But. You know,
that horse of at 10-1, that 10.5-1, that Tivano, $23 in that, you know, smallish field, that 20,000 claimer with Trevor McCarthy, and then in the nightcap,
that was a very hard horse to have as well, and 10-1 seemed like a low price.
And Eddie's, you know, Eddie Barker in the nightcap was 10-1, and you know, she was okay. I mean, she was not impossible. That Empress Luciana.
She was close to impossible. She wasn't impossible, but she was in the vicinity. She was running towards impossible at a high rate of speed. Yeah, it was possible to use 10 of them.
I hear you.
There's a good chance if you use 10 of them that she made the cut, but not an absolute certainty.
Well, it was one of those experiences where, as you just referenced earlier, where you play it because you think, I got to play this. And early on, you say to yourself, I just wasted $46 here. I mean, I felt silly. A couple of stake winners, though. Andy, let's touch on the Jerome winner. I had Harry Weiner yesterday, and don't know if this is a Derby prospect, but he's a nice horse.
You know, he did run well. I mean, you know, I agree. I didn't like him at all. I was completely wrong about him, but he did run well, and I agree. I don't think he's a Derby horse either, and I don't think that the trainer's probably overly optimistic about his chances, but he ran well enough, and he improved enough in his third start to at least suggest that he deserves another chance to show that he doesn't belong in the race, you know? So I was actually sort of impressed by him. It was a funny day because there was a lot of discussion that it was a huge speed track on day, and that helped him. And there is, looking at the races, there's an argument that speed was very beneficial, but there were a few races, I think two, in fact, where horses made huge runs in the back of the pack and finished second, which does throw a little bit of a monkey wrench into the big speed track argument, which I'm always a little skeptical of anyway. And then looking at the buyer speed figures, almost universally, unless you want to use that horse, and there was one other maybe, the horses that ran off on the front end, they didn't get particularly good numbers. They got sort of numbers that fell in line at best with what they do. And I think if you have a track that's heavily biased and it's, you know, really helping speed horses, it goes to say that their numbers are going to be better than you would expect. Just like when you have a super gold rail, you're going to see horses that you know can't run better than 80, run 93. You know, you see it in the figures. When you have a big gold rail, you see it in the figures. That's an absolute. And you see it on turf and dirt. You didn't see this with the speed horses on Friday. So while I'm willing to entertain the notion, I'm a bit skeptical. I'm not saying that horse wasn't helped a little bit by the racetrack, but I don't think that it dramatically increased his performance. So listen, he'll run in the Withers where, you know, I think we're going to see the New York bred that won the Brooklyn Strong, that won the Remsen. There was that, maybe that horse that broke its maiden mileage for Chad Brown, a 2-year-old late in the year. He beat a horse that's in Friday. I think that horse could run in there. It looks like it's possible. And so I think the Withers will be a significantly tougher race, you know? So we'll see what he can do in there. But I was impressed. And maybe I was partly impressed because I didn't like him going in, but I was wrong about that. But I don't think he was just a horse that got lucky and fell into a win.
Agreed. And excited, actually, for Harry.
Yeah, no, it's always nice to see people that, you know, you don't name, you're not familiar with, and have a chance to have a big horse. Listen, it's very early. I was just joking a little on Twitter with Chris Falica, who had some list of horses on the Triple Crown Trail with their odds you can get, whatever site. And there's a couple of horses, I think, potential quality and fundable at 8-1 for the Derby. And I'm not disputing the notion that life is good and essential quality would be the favorites of the Derby now, but it's hard for me to think they're better than 4 or 5% to win, and that seems kind of optimistic. I'd love to own a horse that was 5% to win the Derby in January.
It's funny you bring that up. John Parada and JJ would at this time of year they used to make that same offer. They would say, when the first round of Derby futures, they would say, "Boy, what I wouldn't do to book 19 of these 23 horses."
I'll book them all. I like the discussion of the horses. such.
Yes.
And if somebody has some horse that they're fond of, and horse is 50-1 or more, even if the horse is probably, you know, 0.75% or 0.5%, I understand. There's nothing wrong with that. But somebody is saying, I really, this life is good. You know, Bob wins the Derby a lot. I want to jump in at 8-1, you know, on January 1st and bet him for the Derby. I think Bob would even like to book him. You know, there's so much that can go wrong as opposed to what can go right, you know. So we'll see. But I listen, that doesn't mean that, develop those sources. I'm a little circumspect of essential quality, more so just because he's had fortunate trips when he's won. He has shown the ability to be, you know, to be forward if he needs to be and rate. But he's had such good setups that I want to see him overcome some adversity to win a race. So obviously he's got some talent. Life is Good is obviously very good. I don't really know that much about him, but you know, it's hard to argue against these Stafford horses. He does seem to know how to do well in Triple Crown races.
Well, since we're talking Life is Good and yet another Into Mischief, prospect, I want to ask you about a horse that nobody has seemingly made too much of yet, and maybe it's because it just sort of fell into that pre-Christmas miasma. I was pretty impressed. I know it's just 3/4, but that horse of Christophe Clément's, By George, that won before Christmas, that won the maiden race, the 19th.
Yeah, I want to see how those maiden breakers from Christophe do when they come back. I'm curious to see. But no, he did run a big figure. Listen, a friend of mine is part owner of him, so I hope he wins. I hope he turns into a great horse. So, you know, I'm rooting for him, but I want to see, you know, you want to see more. What day did that horse win? Do you remember?
That was the 19th. I got the chart in front of me.
What race was it?
The fifth. He got an 81
bar. The problem with that is the 19th was a big gold rail, and that horse rode a gold rail.
He was in the one hole.
He rode the gold rail. So that is a horse whose performance was exaggerated by the racetrack. I'm not saying it couldn't be okay, but, you know, I'm going to wait and see what he get, like an 80 buyer, I think?
81.
Yeah. No, but he was very much, very much with the racetrack that day. Of course, I'm looking forward to seeing is that horse of Tony Dutrow's that I was just reading is pointing towards the race on February 7th, the Ruthless or something at Aqueduct. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
It's in our notes. Hang on.
And I had a nice exchange with Tony Dutrow the other day for the holiday, and we touched, and now I'm...
Horses are two names. So Philly. Yeah. She got a 93 buyer when she broke her maiden.
Yes.
Very, very. She beat that good-looking, now 0-2, but Carmel, for Mott. Carmel Swirl, the Godolphin horse that Mott has. Miss Brazil. Miss Brazil is the...
well done, yes.
Granny wrote about her. Yeah, she was very impressive. You know, I'm in a lot of ways, I'm more excited by the girls this right now than I am by the boys because, I mean, I felt like this is as deep and, you know, good looking a group of fillies we've seen. You know, California didn't have any, you know, until that Mandela horse ran badly in the Starlet, but there was that, was it another Mandela horse that broke her maiden with a big figure and, you know, like her third start stretching out at LaSalle? I forget her name. Look good. But, you know, obviously the Breeders' Cup. I mean, there's a slew of horses that ran in the Breeders' Cup Philly, juvenile fillies race that were good. And now you see Miss Brazil runs this. I think Carmel Swirl is good. Todd's horse has some promise as well. That is it Malathot? First it won the Tempted, and then the Demoiselle with the weird
Malathot. Malathot's right. Yeah.
So they're a fun bunch. And so somebody on Twitter was saying to me they were super impressed by the Chad Brown Karovich first year that won search results on Sunday at Gulfstream. And the person said to me, I was first going to win the test. And I said, well, I hope you're right, but I certainly find that unlikely. You know, she got a 71 buyer, and she broke slow, and she had a little bit of traffic, and she ran very well. It was a special. It was a first-time start. I'm not in any way knocking her. And obviously, from a personal standpoint, I'm rooting for her to do great. I'd love to see her with a test. But this is a particularly tough year to see a horse run a 71 Byron's debut in January for a filly and say, I think she's going to win a grade one in the next 6 or 8 months, you know, because there are a lot of good three-year-old fillies working out there. You know, last year at this time, I could abide by the argument better because as of now, last year, the three-year-old filly division was a car wreck. But look how tough it turned out to be, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Look at how good some of the horses came out of nowhere to be. Now, the horses that, you know, had run before didn't do anything, but, you know, look at Swiss Skydiver, who came out of the blue and just, you know, turning this machine. Gamine hadn't raced yet. I mean, obviously, there was some talk about her in California. So, if this year we get some new big shooters in the game, and listen, I hope Search Results is one of them, this is a nice bunch of three-year-old fillies to look forward to running.
Well, and courtesy of Derek Lawson, that Mandela you were thinking of is Moonlight Doro.
Yeah.
87.
She got an 87. Fire,
87. Yeah.
Yeah. No, she looked good. That was her. I think that was her first time going long.
Yeah, going a mile. And although that Frosteria ran back and didn't run great.
Oh, is that the Baffert that ran second?
Yes.
I thought Baffert was second, I thought. Well, listen, I'm not saying she's going to win, but she ran a big number. They're doing two turns. We'll see. I was more pointing her out because California was a rare year where California, you know, had little to offer in the two-year-old filly front, whereas, you know, more East Coast-based horses. And, I know there's this enormous West Coast paranoia, you know, about East Coast bias. It's a foolish thing, but it's a numbers game. There's just a lot more horses on the East Coast, so the likelihood that you're going to get more top horses in the East, it's a numbers game. That's all. It's not a, well, I love California horses. This notion that I have some East Coast bias, I love California racing. I love the races open in Santa Anita.
Andy, it's only the figs that are East Coast biased.
I don't know. I always thought Andy's turf figs in California were too hot.
I'm kidding.
If I was going to criticize it for one thing, I'd say the numbers, the dirt horses seem to be too high. Or maybe they get across the Rockies and they can't run. I'm excited by Charlatan. I don't share the enthusiasm that some seem to have of him being a successful router, but I think 7 furlongs to a mile, I think he's a tremendous horse, and I was thrilled to see his race in the Malibu. That was great, right? It'll be interesting to see what Baffert does with him. I mean, you know, he runs in the Pegasus. Good luck to him. Nick Goh's running in there. Good luck to him. I think Bob's too shrewd for that. Maybe you take the shot for $20 million in the race whose name I have no interest in saying. Yeah. But that's a tough purse to pass up. But I'm skeptical.
Yeah, I hear you.
And I don't see why a one-turn mile and eighth is helpful to a horse like that. I would think a two-turn mile and eighth would be better for him if theoretically he could get the lead because the pace would be slower. But I like Charlton. I just don't really believe he's a true top-class router. I mean, I don't think he's the true top-class horse, because I do.
What, since we went in this direction and touching on the West Coast, Jay was on with us the last hour, Andy. The horse that didn't get a lot of discussion in the wake of Charlatan, and then, of course, the Life is Good this past weekend, but that Duopoly, who I know, you know, people were complaining about the pace, you know, getting away with an easy pace, but...
who Lanny got in that race and she'd be controlling on the front end. She's a funny horse because she's 4-for-4 when she's been in front and 0-for-2 when they have foolishly had an elite, including her debut. And I was laughing because, you know, that's a horse, I will tell you, that Chad told me before she ever ran, because she debuted at Churchill when we were just starting the show. I think it was the first weekend at Churchill. I was doing it in my living room. And that's the horse I asked him about. Because it's owned by Klarovich, and that's, you know, I don't normally ask about horses that aren't owned by Klarovich, and I don't ask about a lot of them. I didn't know anything about the horse that won this weekend on Sunday. But Chad said, this is a stakes horse. He was confident in that horse before she ever ran. He liked her a lot. Listen, when you're able to dictate like that, you always say, well, what happens when she can't? And it's a fair question, because she's been great when she's been able to control. But, you know, well, the same could have been said for that Good Horse of Grand Motions, right?
Yeah, Jerry.
What's it? Mary.
Oh, Mean Mary. Mean Mary.
Yeah, I mean, so we'll see. But Duopoly was good. She was in the shadow of Charlatan, as everybody, but she was very good.
We're probably not going to have time now, but we've got plenty of time the next couple of weeks. I do want to get some Eclipse thoughts from you in terms of...
My Eclipse thoughts are, there's a lot of people voting out there that shouldn't have a vote. That's my Eclipse thought. I'm tired of people pretending to say that they're impressing people on Twitter by showing that they're not going to vote for horses because they had a positive test and all this nonsense. I'm tired of the politicization of everything, and I think people should be more responsible about their voting, and I wish the Eclipse Awards were handled. I know some very responsible voters like yourself, but I also have seen some ballots that are disgraceful. That's all I have to say about that.
No, I'm glad I asked, because that was...
I mean, some of these people should be ashamed of themselves. I'm just trying to get attention, you know, just using their ballots on Twitter to get attention. Good for you. You shouldn't have a vote. That's the only thing I have to say to them. I'm done.
Perfect ending. Andy Serling, everybody. And, of course, we're back this week and back on Thursday. There we go. Andy Serling. We're going to stay here. We got 20 minutes to fill out and... Frank Hopf is going to join us, and we're chasing Frank down at Sam Houston Race Park. And speaking of, you know, racing coming up, well, SHRP, and I'm going to check and see, the quick sheet is ready. We'd love the quick sheet. And Friday is opening night at Sam Houston. And, you know, because of some situations, Sam Houston is going to have a lot of evenings, you know, they're going to be the focus, and 6:45 Central kickoff time to these cards. And you know, the last couple of years have been very noteworthy, and Sam Houston has become an absolute destination signal. And here's Frank Hopf now. Frank, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, Steve.
We're just getting excited. You know, you got out in front of it. You got the first card up, and the schedule is set. And hopefully, you know, we certainly have to deal with some COVID, continued COVID fallout. But it doesn't feel like the meet will be as interrupted as last year's was.
That's certainly the hope and plan. We're ready to go. We're going to put every precaution we can to protect the meet and have a safe meet for all the participants. But we are certainly ready to go on Friday night.
You know, talk a little bit about you know, how you know, obviously the way things ended, where, you know, more or less the, you know, you were imposed upon by you know, by the health issues, subsequently, and in planning for this year, Frank, talk a little bit about, you know, what SHRP, you know, you probably have had to kind of bob and weave and you know, tea leaf read and you know, keep taking the pulse of the community too, and you know, everybody's dealing with local health officials.
Yeah, that's certainly been the case for us, I'm sure, as well for all other tracks and society in general. But yeah, we were actually, after the thoroughbred meet ended, we actually closed down for 2 months. So there was no simulcast operations. We reopened back in early June, certainly put in a lot of precautions and working and understanding what we needed to do within, you know, the state and county governments. And, you know, we've put in a lot of those precautions in, and we've been able to stay open and, you know, have everyone social distance, wear their masks, keep the place clean. So once we got that going with the simulcast operations, then we turned our attention to the upcoming racing season. And, you know, obviously working with the horsemen associations here in Texas and putting our plan together, you know, everything kind of came into place. And, you know, once the plan was set, you know, here we are a couple days away from opening night.
Well, and there really seemed to be, taking a pulse off of things like Twitter and other social media when your backstretch opened, you know, I saw a lot of people saying, you know, sending our string, you know, we're getting our, even as much as, you know, people saying, oh, I got, you know, 16 stalls at Sam Houston. And then when, you know, training got going, you could tell people were excited about, in some cases, coming home or, you know, being able to at least start the year in a nice, familiar fashion. Talk a little bit about the schedule in general. Let's give everybody the lay of the land for the next 4 months.
Yeah, so we are going to continue with our Friday and Saturday night evening race card. That will be a 6:45 Central post. So that will continue throughout the season, the thoroughbred and the quarter horse meet. What we did this year is we move into a Thursday late afternoon post. That first post will be a 4 o'clock Central. And, you know, I think that's an opportunity to expose Sam Houston Race Park to some bettors that may not play us, because we do run generally Friday and Saturday nights. And I think there's just a nice spot within the racing calendar that it's a nice opportunity, again, just to kind of showcase what we're doing here at Houston and Texas racing, and just try to continue to grow the product and, you know, give the bettors, you know, something with low takeouts that might interest them with, you know, again, hopefully competitive racing in full fields.
That's really been what has raised Sam Houston's consciousness in to the players. You guys made a commitment to, you know, aggressively price the wagering options, and you know, then the aspect of what Texas has done with this tax system that really breathed life into the purse structures at everywhere, at Retama and at Lone Star and at Sam Houston. It has really been a shot in the arm, and it seemed like I think it was with Steve. I think Steve Asmussen actually was the person who first started to beat this drum and say how appreciative that, you know, he was and his clients were at the opportunity to run at home instead of having to go, you know, run in other environs, you know, when people are Texas based and they want to see their horses and they want to run for competitive purses.
Yeah. I mean, we've, you know, the state of Texas has been lucky with some, you know, some really good trainers that, you know, have gone to other jurisdictions just to run and, you know, and have competitive purses. And, you know, certainly that put, you know, racing down here in Texas kind of in a tough spot for a long time. And, you know, obviously with legislation and the bill that passed back in 2019, it's certainly given a shot in the arm for all the tracks here. You know, obviously we could always, we said we have good racing surfaces, we got nice takeouts, but again, we understood where we kind of stood with the purse structure, and just having the opportunity to, you know, showcase the track surfaces and the takeouts, and now we can put together a good racing program with trainers coming from around the country is certainly exciting for everyone down here.
Let's touch on some of the mileposts along the way. And you know, when you talk about people circling a date, you know, you guys made a commitment to a big dollar race for fillies and mares, and it became very quickly a success. And this ended up being, you know, the Ladies Classic ended up being a fairly smart stroke of genius, because it attracted exactly the kinds of horses you were hoping for.
Yeah, that, you know, when that race was put together, you know, 7-8 years ago, you know, I think the goal was to get it, you know, see how quickly we could try to get it graded and continue to go up the graded ranks. And, you know, we've been very fortunate with, you know, the trainers that have come here, and certainly the fillies and mares that have run in this race, you know, with Forever Unbridled, Midnight Bizou, and, you know, it's just been something that's really helped the race and the day itself with the racing festival that's now grown to 6 open stake races, you know, including the Grade 2 or the Grade 3 John B. Conley and the new 200,000 Texas Turf Mile for 3-year-olds. So, you know, we've been really fortunate, really appreciative of, you know, those trainers and horsemen and owners that have come down to Houston in, you know, late January to run here and, you know, and allow these horses to start their seasons off here and continue to grow throughout the racing season for them.
Yeah, I'm going to put up actually the calendar too for people to see, you know, so that they can see how things lay out. And I suppose as part of the discussion, we can't forget what the Texas Bred program means. And you know, in addition to obviously the complete condition book, you know, support for purses, this also very important to the Texas Bred program. And that's a you know, a major part of you know, the cards that are put together, the stake dates as well. We're going to talk about, in fact, why don't you lay it out? You got the Texas Bred program, and we have that. We do have that carryover to mention too. That was unable to. You weren't able to run the Texas Bred Stakes that day night, and the money's been, you know, kind of sitting waiting to be distributed.
That's right. So with the Texas Stakes program, you know, obviously, you know, one of the big key factors is to grow racing down here in Texas. And, you know, I think part of that plan, you know, from Sam Houston's standpoint was to put together a state-bred stakes program that would drive some interest for breeders and owners and, you know, have their horses come and start running down here in Texas again. And, you know, one thing that we put together was a, you know, kind of a preview day, so kind of a lead up to what, you know, we've always ran as our Texas Champions Day. And we've taken a couple of the Stallion Stakes races, and, you know, we created some new Texas Bred Stakes for the preview day, which will be on February 20th. And those were all going to be at $75,000 each race. And then, obviously, this year with Texas Champions Day, you know, obviously we were able to finish that card in 2020, but, you know, we felt that it was important to continue to build the program. And we actually increased all of these stakes races up to $100,000 each race. So, you know, obviously that's the plan is to just continue to build Texas breeding and the racing program down here. You know, it's going to take some time. Obviously, that doesn't happen overnight, and, you know, fully aware of that. And we just continue to see that program build and to where those races, you know, could purse levels can grow even higher, and it comes a real successful day and leads into, you know, the meetup with Lone Star as well. So that's kind of what we're doing, working, you know, closely with the Texas Thoroughbred Association, and you know, we're Texans and we'll get it done, that's for sure. With obviously with leading into the carryover, you know, yeah. We weren't able to finish the Texas Champions Day program in 2020. So that left us with a little under $52,000 carryover from the Space City Pick 6. So opening night, that money will be put into the Pick 6 pool. So it'll be $51,809 was carried over from last year plus some interest. So we will put that in the pools on Friday night. And then on Saturday night, January 9th, we will do a mandatory payout on the Space City Pick 6. So, obviously, that's money that's been sitting from 2020. We want to get that back out and paid out to the bettors that, you know, have been participating last year and those who will participate on the first two nights of the season.
Nice. And once this is distributed, once this is forced out by Saturday, are you going to start a new Space City, or are you going to change the format?
Yeah, so we'll continue with the Space City Pick 6. I have a tote test from the Racing Commission going on right now. And the plan is on Thursday, January 14th, that the Pick 6 will go to a standard payout, no longer a jackpot option, at our standard 12% takeout here at Sam Houston. So once everything gets official, we'll be getting all that information out. But that is the plan, that January 14th, our first Thursday card, our Space City Pick 6 will no longer have that jackpot payout option.
Do you have you determined what you're going to do? That's great news, Frank. Have you determined what the denomination is going to be? You're going to do $50, $1, $2?
We will go with a 50-cent minimum.
Interesting.
And it
okay.
will have a 75 minor pool and a 25% major pool. So that is the plan. We're looking forward to
nice.
Seeing how that is responded to by the betting public.
Interesting.
And, and tying with our pick five, we hope that we see some success in the new format of the pick six.
That's great. That's interesting, too, because as opposed to the 20 cent, 50 cent is bigger than the 20. And so a 75% payout and Conso's 5 of 6, 25% of the pool. And if there is a carryover, what percentage of the pool would carry over if nobody hits?
It would be 75%.
Okay. Okay, so 25%, I got it, would go to the Conso that day and 75 into the next day. Minutes ago with Andy Serling, we were just talking, Naira's tinkering as well, and they're doing a daily force out, essentially, in January, and it does feel like the worm is turning away from the jackpot concept. So we'll promote this plenty. We'll play it. And in fact, Nick Tamaro will be on with us regularly. Nick does the, he does the morning line for Sam Houston. And I got a sense we're going to be playing plenty.
That's great. Yeah, I know Nick's excited about the upcoming season as well. And I know you guys do a great job talking some Sam Houston for us. So I certainly appreciate that as well.
Well, and looking at the fields and, the first couple of cards that are up and available, and Friday night, opening night, Saturday, forcing out that pot, and then starting fresh next Thursday. Terrific. Frank, safe meet for everybody, and best of luck. Anything you need communicated, don't hesitate to let us know.
I certainly appreciate it, sir, and you have a happy, wonderful new year as well, and stay safe as well.
Frank Hoff, everybody, who is racing director, of course, at SHRP, Chris Griffin. I'm sure we'll get to hear from Chris quite a bit during the meet as well. And they start Friday, and the Thoroughbreds run until the first Saturday in April. And, of course, that'll be Wood Memorial Day and Santa Anita Derby Day and Bluegrass Day, and hopefully they can get some people through the turnstiles at some point as well. But in the meantime, those of us out and about, Sam Houston back on your wagering menu Friday and Saturday nights and Thursday late afternoons. This was another rocket sled morning. Bill Gallo and Jay Pribman, Graham Motion, Andy Serling, and Frank Hopf. Good luck if you're playing today, everybody. Back with you tomorrow, Wednesday. We got our first visit in with Sid. Looking forward to Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill & Dale. And we'll talk to Ed. We'll get Ed DeRosa in here. And, and take a mallet to his Eclipse palette. No, I'm just kidding. That's something people look forward to every year. Mind giving Ed the business? He's down there giving them the business. Good luck today, everybody. Talk to you in the morning. Thank you.
racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows